actually.
Okay. We're going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. The time now is 2:47 p.m. on Friday, March 17th, 2017. We've got a full house today present. We have Representative Ortiz, Pruitt, Kawasaki, Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Gren, Guttenberg. Sitting in for Representative Thompson today is Representative Newman, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. Representative Newman is excused. And before we start, please
Thompson,
do...
Thompson is.
I'm sorry. Representative Thompson is excused today. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. At this meeting, we will have our second hearing on SB 30, approval of royalty oil sale to Petrostar, and it's my intent to have committee discussion. And then, if it is the will of the committee to move this bill out of House Finance, we will then finish our amendments on the permanent fund portion of HB 115. So with that, at this time, we'll bring back SB 30, and we have an Ed King out here. Ed, he's from the Department of Natural Resources. If you could come to the table and place yourself on the record, and do you have any opening statements before we proceed with questions?
For the record, Ed King, Special Assistant Commissioner of Natural Resources. Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, I don't have any opening remarks. Just here to answer any questions of the committee. Mr. Jim Shine is on the phone as well as Mr. Johnny Mesa, if the committee has any questions.
Real good. Okay. And with that, any questions of the committee? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on the fiscal note, so could you tell me what the non-UGF other, what fund that is that the other 1.945 is going toward?
The three funds being the general fund, the permanent fund, and then the school trust fund.
Thank you.
Okay, any further questions? And as was mentioned, we have Jim Shine also online. Looks like we had no amendments to this bill. And looks like Representative Guerra was going to read in the fiscal note for SB 30 into the record.
I was. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, we have only one fiscal note?
Yes.
Labeled number two? All right. Fiscal note number two, which is apparently the one fiscal note, from the Department of Natural Resources, is a zero fiscal note in terms of expenditures with an addition in revenues in FY18 of $3.852 million and higher numbers afterwards. Fiscal note is dated February 8th, 2017, OMB component number 439.
Are there any questions on the fiscal note? Mr. King?
And Mr. Chair, just for the record and for clarity on the numbering of the fiscal notes, there was an initial fiscal note that was entered. There was a technical error made in the translation because the contract is made under calendar years. Translating that to fiscal years, there was an original error which was corrected. There is only one fiscal note.
Okay, thank you. Okay, before we move the bill from committee, are there any final questions? Seeing none, Representative Seaton, if I can have a motion.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move SB 30 version 30GS1873/A from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Okay, any objections? Seeing no objections, SB 30 moves from the House Finance Committee. And with that, we'll just take a brief at ease to send the paper around. Finance Committee is back on record, and our next piece of legislation today is HB 115. We're returning to specific amendments that we did not finish addressing at our last meeting. And Representative Wilson, you had Amendments 16 and 17.
I do, Mr. Chair.
So I move Amendment Number 15. Okay, so Mr. Chairman, I don't know whether or not we have new copies. We did go to Legal, and in your packet should be the new ones.
Let's take a brief at ease here. Okay, House Finance is back on record, and Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to withdraw Amendments 16 and 17.
Okay, Amendments 16 and 17 have been withdrawn. And with that, Representative Wilson, can I have a motion to bring Amendment 18?
Mr. Chairman. First of all, I want to say thank you very much to the committee allowing me to have some time so that we had drafted correctly, and I also have a legal to go along with that. So with that, I move Amendment Number 18.
Okay, is there an objection? We have an objection. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. And what Amendment Number 18 does is allows an advisory vote to approve legislative action that appropriate money from the earnings reserve account for a purpose other than a payment of a permanent fund dividend. This would not overturn any legislation. It would. What I think it does is it forces the conversation out into the public and gives them a voice. Thank you.
Okay, any questions of Representative Wilson? Representative Seaton?
Thank you. I note that on number 18 here on line 10, it's at the next primary election that would be held in August of not this year, but the following year. Is that the intention of this amendment?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes. We didn't want, in the fiscal climate that we're in right now, We absolutely didn't want to cause more elections with it. It also, this is a pretty complicated discussion, and I also didn't want to have it rushed because it could be, depending upon what legislation does or doesn't pass, it also will give that opportunity for people to see perhaps whether or not whatever has been proposed is or is not working.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not for a question, I mean, when we come to discussion. Unless we're there.
We're there, unless somebody else has a question of Representative Wilson. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to oppose Amendment 18 because I think that what this would do would be to put off the immediacy of the discussion and development of the bills. Everything would be kind of in limbo because we're asking a question of the population of should we proceed with looking at what we're already doing or have done. And if the population doesn't like what we've done, then there is a procedure of a referendum that can go forward. But having an advisory vote on it would then mean that I think that is just leading us down a blind trail and not addressing the issue that we need to address. So I'm going to oppose going to an advisory vote a year and a half from now as to whether we should make this fix to our fiscal system.
Got a question from Representative, or a comment from Representative Newman?
I thought we were discussion on the amendment.
We are.
Correct, yes.
Okay, so discussion?
Correct, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I support this amendment. I know that I've heard from many folks up in my district and around the state about how they feel the purpose of the permanent fund dividend is they're part of the royalty share, and this is the people's part of the royalty share. This the portion of this that allows for a public vote, I think it's a good idea and something I support. Mr. Chair, there's many diverse views on how the permanent fund should be dividend, should be used, how it should be spent, where it belongs, if it's the states or whatever. And I think the best way we can do that is by a public advisory vote and hear exactly from the public. Chair Seaton suggested that it would be interfere with maybe other bills in the flow. Well, we don't know if those bills are passing. We don't know if those bills may be amended. I suspect there'll probably be amendments to try and put other citizen advisory votes into those bills somewhere along the line, and we don't know if those are going to pass or not, so I don't know if that's really a reason. But, Mr. Chair, also, you know, I just got a report back from Revenue 2 days ago. We have over $15 billion still in reserves, 10.6 in the earnings reserve, and 4.5 in the CBR. Our deficits are running $3 billion. To me, I don't see the crisis in this and where we still got over $15 billion in savings. Quite frankly, Mr. Chair, I don't think we should be using the permanent fund dividend for government while we have that much money in savings and reserves to fund government. So, Mr. Speaker, I do support this. I do think that the public should have a voice in this. I think many in the public feel that the permanent fund dividend does belong to the public as a whole, just as much as it belongs to the state government, and I think we should let them decide. So I do support this, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions of the committee? Senator Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I too am concerned, along with Representative Newman, but I think for other issues as well. I mean, I'll start off with what we have in the bank. I mean, we've sat here in this legislature for the past few years, and every session, a group of economists and consultants and money managers come in and say, you know, you have the money, create an endowment process to get a stream of revenue, and you know, if you don't do it this year, you're going to have $3 million less to do it next year, and $3 million next to do it next year, and $3 billion less to do it next year, and you know, we cannot wait 2 more years. I mean, you know, I mean, this is an advisory vote. We're going to go through this entire legislative process, what's left, an entire another legislature, and then there's going to be, and then in the primary, you're going to have a vote on action that was taken almost a year and a half, 2 years before that. It's an advisory question. Representative Wilson talked about people might be out there looking to put something on the ballot as well. If they do that, then that'll be clean language and not having two measures on the ballot, probably asking the same question. You know, I know we have the authority that one doesn't affect the other, but I think if to have two questions basically would be similar on the ballot would be questionable, even if, you know, I don't know what it would say, don't even know what's going to happen. But I think for those people that would be out there trying to do something, because this really is just an advisory vote, trying to do something that actually try to make something happen, or just another advisory vote, having two of them a year and a half after the fact is not going to help. I mean, I think, you know, you can ask this question 10 different ways and get 10 different answers. But I think, you know, to put this on this bill and pass this, whatever it holds up, whatever we're going to be doing is going to be tough. And I think it is time to act now. And although an advisory vote is down the road, is, you know, if there are people that want to put it on the ballot, let them put it on the ballot.
Any further, Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, just real quick. I mean, I think we're going to have an advisory vote whether we put it there or whether a referendum comes forward. There's going to be an advisory vote on this whole thing. The question is there a problem with just letting the people speak to it? And, you know, I just, that part, I don't have a problem with the people saying something. You know, that the legislature then gets to determine whether or not they want to follow what the people said. They don't have the ability to tell us you can or can't do that. But it might be that they, let's say they were going to, you know, overwhelmingly said, no, we don't like it, and the legislature says, well, we're going to keep doing it. At least at that point in time, there's pressure to recognize that even if the legislature decides they're going to keep doing it, that they have in the back of their mind, they got to be very careful what they are doing, because the people are watching them. I guess that's the best way to put it. So I don't have a problem with an advisory vote at all, and I think we should let this go forward. If this moves forward, let's give the people a chance. And I'll remind people that why are the public so involved with thinking that there should be that there's this discussion about vote and their role in that? It's because politicians for 30 years have said that they would never touch the permanent fund, and not every politician. I don't want to paint that brush, but there's some that they've driven that in the mind where it's almost part of the lexicon now. Well, I thought we weren't going to use the permanent fund for anything else other than if the people voted for it. And so I guess we can blame some of the people that came before us for putting that mindset out there, but I think this allows the people to be as involved as possible, and it will help us ensure that we're on track no matter what we decide to do this year or going forward. So I would support this.
Further discussion? Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I speak in support of this amendment and of allowing an advisory vote. I think we heard that talk about timing, and I know that there's been the question of advisory vote in previous legislatures, and maybe if we'd heeded that, we wouldn't be where we are right now and pushing that ability for the public to have their opportunity to have a voice in this matter. We wouldn't be sitting here now asking for an advisory vote again. So I very much support this amendment.
Further discussion? Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Part of our job is to make sure we don't fool the public. And there's a statement made that we've got lots of savings and we could just spend them. But what you're talking about is roughly $9 billion of money that's in the permanent fund earnings reserve that's being called savings. And if you spend that, you won't have the money to pay a dividend. So at the end of this fiscal year, we'll have less than $3 billion left in what used to be $17 billion of savings. And then the next year, that'll be gone, and you'll start dipping into the earnings reserve to pay for government. And then very soon, you won't have the money to pay a dividend. Even under the most radical plans with the most radical school cuts you've heard in this building, you're going to run through that money. And it's tough when you have to actually let your constituents know that there's a problem that isn't easy to solve with a bumper sticker. But I don't consider the earnings reserve just savings we should spend through, because then mathematically there's no way to pay a dividend. So I hope we can work together and figure out a way to move forward so we can protect a dividend. I can't sell to the public that you can just spend through what's left of our savings, then spend through the earnings reserve, because the truth is then you have no dividend. And I don't want to try and, I'm not going to sell that to my public.
Representative Wilson.
Just again, when are we ready for wrap up? Are we, make sure everybody else has spoken. So for wrap up, you know, sometimes I forget what the amendment even is, okay? So I think it's actually a good thing that it's not happening right away. This doesn't slow anything down. Whether or not a bill is passed or whether or not what's in the budget currently happens without another bill gives time for whatever is going to take place to happen, and then allows the public to look at it and see whether or not they believe it was the right choice or the wrong choice. It doesn't stop anything from going on. It's kind of interesting because the conversation sounds like everybody thinks it's going to fail. I think it's a conversation that we owe the public, because we have arguments just amongst us, and there's nobody else who's probably more engaged in what's been going on with all the different bills that are in here. That same conversation isn't happening in the public, and that's what an advisory vote allows to happen, is to say whether we did it or we didn't do it. But let's say the budget bill passes as it is today, maybe much lower, but all the other things are in there. And then we go next year and we have a budget bill, and even if legislation doesn't pass with it, come August, it's not just us that are going to be judging whether or not what's working is working, and that we're not hurting the dividend, or we're not hurting the permanent fund, corpus, any fund, or the earnings reserve. We're going to be forced as legislators, if we choose to be involved, and if we're going to run, we are to have a specific conversation with our constituents. And I don't think that's ever a bad thing. And I don't think we should stop what we're doing here in any kind of fashion. That is not what this is here for. And that's why it is an advisory vote. I know of no group at this point who plans on putting anything on the ballot, but that may be because nothing's actually passed this legislation. But I think this makes us take another level of making sure that we get the word out to our constituents, no matter which side you fall on. But we'll actually have information, most likely, to be able to say, yes, it worked, or no, it didn't work. And I think that's really what the advisory vote is about. It's not to stop anything. It's not necessarily to reverse anything. But just the public conversation and helping people understand the difference between the corpus, the earnings, and all these things and how it's going to possibly affect them can only be a good thing. And I live in one of the most redneck areas. I'll guarantee you, when I go door-to-door, I'm going to hear on both sides that kind of a thing. But I welcome that conversation because I think as we move forward, it's going to help us. And a lot of these bills have sunsets on them or have days where they're going to, 3 years are going to be re-looked at. And this would be in possibly year two. So I just want to make sure that everybody understands I'm not putting this here to stop anything. It's forcing a conversation that we will have to have if it's on the ballot. Otherwise, we just kind of do our thing on this basically island, for a better way of putting it, and not involving our constituents. And I think we owe it to them.
Okay. Is the objection maintained? Sounds like it is. Okay. If we could get a roll call vote.
Representative Kawasaki?
No.
Representative Ortiz?
No.
Representative Pruitt?
Yes.
Representative Newman?
Yes.
Representative Tilton?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Guerra?
No.
Representative Gren?
No.
Representative Guttenberg?
No.
Representative Seaton?
No.
Representative Foster?
No.
4 yea, 7 nay.
Okay, and on a vote of 4 yea and 7 nay, Amendment 18 fails. Representative Wilson, your next amendment.
I move amendment number 19.
Okay.
Is an objection, Representative Wilson?
Feels special, it's two. Mm-hmm. So this is just authorizing an advisory vote, you know, for before we put an income tax in. Same thing, same kind of conversation happening. I'll keep it at that because I'm pretty sure I know how the votes are going to land. Okay. Thank you.
Any discussion from the committee? Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, a lot of the same comments from the previous one, the previous amendment, but also I want to add, you know, I heard a really strong message that act. Just go down there and act. Do something. For me, this is clearly, well, yeah, maybe, you know, we'll do this, and then, you have an advisory vote. I think the people of the state of Alaska want us to see us to do something, and that's clearly a strong message. You know, if there's enough emphasis in the communities that they want to put something on the ballot, I strongly support that. But I think we need to act and not be second-guessing ourselves by supporting an advisory vote. We just need to act. We need to do something. That's what my voters have told me. You know, we do something, what happens after that happens after that, but it's do something.
We've got Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I go through the emails and from all around the state and talk to the folks in my district, an income tax is the least favorable option that I have ever heard for funding government.
to have a vote of the people to ask them, and for the people who think it's income tax, sales tax, we've heard it all on both sides of this, to ask them about whether we can do this or not. And on the issue of, well, can we wait to have a vote on this because of the state's budget situation again? And whether it's an income tax or the use of the permanent fund dividend, I go back to the fact we still have over $15 billion. And just like this income tax, it's taking money out of the economy that we're going into a recession, and that I'm very concerned about, Mr. Chair. The recession coming on, and there's reduction out of the money. And I'm trying to stay away from the PFD thing, obviously, because that's not the amendment. I'm trying to stick to the amendment, Mr. Chair. But an advisory vote on doing this, we do have the money to wait. We can, I believe that this budget out of this body is to use the money out of the earnings reserve this year. It still leaves, again, a 4.5 out of the CBR, and does not affect the permanent fund dividend because that's made out of the corpus of the earnings. So I do support this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it is not very not very useful to put a blanket non-specific issue on an advisory vote saying an income tax, because an income tax can be constructed in a number of different ways. And so until there are some specifics that people can react to, then you really aren't going to be able to get anything other than a generalized opinion of something that people don't really have an idea what you're talking about. You could have a very low, you could have very high, you could have it based on federal tax, you could have it based on adjusted income, you could, you know. So until you have those aspects of it, as well as whether it taxes non-residents as well as residents, whether it's, you know, all of those portions, it's really not a very useful. And I think that what it does is it gives an impetus to delay and not solve our fiscal problem, and not use this technique anyway for helping solve our fiscal problem. And I think that most of us know we have to have more than just a single source of revenue. So I'm opposed to this amendment.
If Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a couple of thoughts about this, and this is a little different. Obviously, this is an income tax as opposed to the permanent fund. I don't think it matters the structure of an income tax. I don't think it matters the percentage. I don't think it matters. There's a psychological thought process that goes into someone's mind when you say income tax. And most people don't say, oh, that's cool, you're only going to take 4% of my paycheck. But if you go to 8%, I'm not cool with. There's a psychological discussion. We don't need a framework here. We need to. I think the fear on this one is probably fear that we'll actually get the results that we expect, and that's that the people don't want an income tax. I'm pretty confident that as a state, from my interactions, yes, there are people that are passionate and they'd love to see it, but I think we'd find in the overwhelming majority of people that this is probably not the direction. I may be wrong, but at the same time, I don't care. They can tell me I'm wrong. I'm not afraid of them telling me that I'm wrong. And so I think there's nothing wrong with giving the people the opportunity to say yes or no, it's something you can look into, or no, find some other way to get around that. Now, that being said, the one of the things that I think is interesting is that one of the reasons said not to do this is because we're putting something off. Let me remind you that we grew the budget from what the governor gave us. That's putting it off. So to argue that this puts it off, no, it doesn't put it off. No, we have the ability right now to be dealing with some of this stuff, and we're going to deal with the aspects of it. I think the permanent fund discussion, we saw the other body has moved forward on something there. There's I think to hold this up that this is going to be what delays, I think the budget that we were just discussing today, that's a key piece of what we're delaying. And so I'm not afraid of the people telling us yes or no. Then maybe they'll prove me completely wrong on the income tax, and if that's the case, thank you. Thank you for letting me know. And I don't have a problem with any sort of an advisory vote on an income tax that makes sure that I understand that I am speaking for the people that I'm representing in the manner that I understand. That's the best poll you can ever have is have them actually go to the polls and vote.
Representative Kawasaki.
So actually, I mean, I think this debate could be sealed right now because in 2015, in December, Rasmussen Foundation did poll people on a bunch of different things, and an income tax was one of them. And they did two questions on the income tax. The first one was, do you want to have an income tax? And it was resoundingly no, 25% maybe voted in the affirmative, and there were many that weren't sure. And then the second question was, would you like an income tax if it's if you make, or would you want to have an income tax if you didn't make more than $100,000? Or no, the income tax wouldn't affect you unless you made $100,000. And overwhelmingly, people supported that. So I think the point is that the structure of this will, I mean, it will change the outcome of the answer to that question. Again, we saw those results when the Rasmussen Foundation published those polls. Some people don't want to be taxed, but if they don't make $100,000, they said, yeah, sure, that's fine. Can you
see the numbers? Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The problem I have with this amendment and the last one is they prevent us from leveling with the public. There are some really generous people who say, hey, I'd like to pay an income tax, and they don't realize that doesn't solve the budget deficit. There are people who've offered up their dividend. That doesn't solve the budget deficit. And who would want – I don't want anybody to offer up their whole dividend. And I want a bigger dividend personally than what people got last year. But at some point, you can't just make up money. The budget deficit is so big that even some people in my own party don't get it. Okay? So this isn't a political thing. There are politicians, I believe, in my own party that don't get it. The budget deficit is so big that an income tax can't solve it. A reasonable use of earnings so that you can maintain a better dividend than we had last year, even that doesn't solve it. I haven't heard another fiscal plan from anybody else at this table, but let's say you wanted a sales tax, even that can't solve it. And even radical cuts to education and the university and domestic violence shelters so we shrivel up the services the state provides, that can't solve it. You're going to run out of savings. And so to shine on the public and say, which one of these things that will prevent a recession from lasting for 10 years don't you want? We have to decide how to shorten this recession so that people have an economy and jobs and schools and opportunity. There's not a single one of these plans between budget cuts and an income tax or use of earnings or even a sales tax, not a single one of them or even two of them that solves the budget gap. It's so big. And I'm not going to blame anybody for the drop in the price of oil, which was $120 a barrel, and now it's less than $50. And that's the biggest part of our budget gap. And I don't want...
One moment, Representative Guerra. Representative Newman, your point of order.
Mr. Chair, I could have went on a long ways about different ways we could fund government or why we shouldn't, but I was trying to state of the amendment budget, or the amendment, which is whether there should be an advisory vote for an income tax.
Representative Guerra, confine your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to put a part of a fiscal plan to a public vote, just like any other bill in this legislature, every time you pass a bill, you're going to put it to a public vote. It would let people shine the public on, and I don't want to do that. What we have right now is a math problem. And the math problem is massive, and if we don't solve it, there will be a 10-year recession. And I'm not willing to do that to people just to get votes. Thank you.
Representative Wilson, did you want to wrap up?
Yeah. Obviously, we can say anything we want here, because to say that somebody's going to go out there and be dishonest about what's going on, that's what we keep saying here, I don't appreciate. And we keep talking about how radical cuts have been. Again, I don't know where they're coming from. I don't know when it became a crime to ask the public who put us here what they think. I mean, that's what this does. But you would think, you know, that's all this does. Because there's groups of the state who believe that different things can happen. Having a conversation with our constituents is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. And I don't go lie to my constituents. We have those honest conversations. And I really, it's appalled that that's why we wouldn't want to do this, because we wouldn't be honest about what's going on. I just heard on the floor not too long ago, we have a fully funded budget. Right now, before we do anything else. So if that's true, what is the harm of asking people? No, I don't think you do that for every piece of legislation, but I think naming the ferries and doing a couple of other bills that we've done, you know, don't require that. But this is starting a completely different way of doing things that Alaska haven't had to deal with for a long time. And if we can't show them the numbers and show them what the options are, if we do this through cuts, or if we do this through income tax, or we do this through the other options, then maybe we shouldn't be sitting here in the first place. This isn't a political football. It is our responsibility to listen to our constituents, but sometimes on bigger issues like this, they have a right to weigh in a different way than trying to call in based on our schedules, our email in on this. But it just feels like I've almost committed a crime, because I somehow believe that people have a right to vote on the bigger issues coming before them. And this, not very useful, not specific. You're going to tax my income. That's pretty specific. And I think most people can look at their pocketbooks and know how that's going to affect them. Companies and businesses are going to be able to look and know how much extra money they have during these times. I just think certain things raise to the top, and this is one of those. And again, if we've got a fully funded budget, this particular one makes no sense why we wouldn't want to go out and have the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Representative Seaton, do you maintain your objection?
I do.
Okay. And can the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Ortiz?
No.
Representative Crowe?
Yes.
Representative Newman?
Yes.
Representative
Tilton?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Representative
Guerra?
No.
Representative Grant?
No.
Representative
Gunther?
No.
Representative Kawasaki?
No.
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Seaton?
No.
Okay, and on a vote of 4 yea and 7 nay, Amendment 19 fails. I'd like to move on to, we're going to return to Amendment 12. We had rolled that down in our previous meeting. It's my understanding that Representative Pruitt will be carrying the amendment for Representative Thompson, who is excused today. So with that, Representative Pruitt, can I have a motion?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Amendment number 12.
Okay, and just for the record, that's 30-LSO125/E.27. Is there an objection?
I'll object for discussion.
Okay, we've got an objection. Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So what we are doing here is, many of you may be aware, I hope you're aware, of the five-year limitation within the CBR that requires that we are a little bit more conservative with the way that the CBR is managed based on the potential need for liquidity. In a couple years ago, at the onset of this new administration, the Commissioner Hofbeck made a decision that I think was one probably required currently by statute, but he probably would have needed to do it anyways, that moved our CBR from being managed in a more aggressive manner to being managed in a way that, if we needed it, would be more available. That usually means that it makes less money. The concern is that if you need it within the next 5 years, there's a potential that you could be putting your money, not having your money work for you as hard as it could. Needing it within 2 or 3 years might make sense, but 5 years might be a little long. If you think about it, if you were to take this current hole that we have, the $3 billion, and you put 5 years on it, let's say we had 15, which we've never had that much in the CBR. We've gotten close, but not fully there. That is a substantial amount of money that it would that you could be earning a very good rate of return on, but because you feel that you may need it, and maybe you do, maybe you don't, we have made it so that you have to invest it at that lower rate. So this particular amendment removes that requirement. Now, and I don't want to speak for the Department of Revenue, it still requires them to invest it in a manner for which it, if it does, there is the assumption that we will need that liquidity, that it is available to us. So it doesn't just let them kind of go for a free roll. They still have to, and they have money managers over there that do this, they'll still have to keep that that mindset of the need available in their decision making as they look to manage that money. So I think it's a very good amendment. Appreciate Representative Thompson bringing it forward. And if there are questions, we do have the commissioner here. We do have Representative Thompson's staff and maybe even others out there that might be able to help answer some questions that might come up. So with that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. With that, let's go ahead and bring up Commissioner Hoffbeck and also Mr. Brandon Brzezewski.
Yeah.
And since we have two male voices for transcription, if you could just state your name prior to speaking. And Representative Seaton has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, this seems like a logical thing to do. I want to make sure that it works into the bill, the State Revenue Restructuring Act, and how this would work within that bill.
So, the Chair, Representative Seaton, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. It really works in there in two distinct ways. One, of course, is that by having greater flexibility for investing the monies within the CVR, as Representative Pruitt stated, allows us to increase the amount of returns on those investments, which is critical at a time where all of our financial assets need to be used as efficiently as possible and achieve the greatest risk-balanced returns that we can achieve. Secondly, because of the way that the structure that the permanent fund restructuring will have as far as permanent fund corporation itself, we're trying to set up a situation where they don't have to change their investment policies in order to meet the draw that's going to be required under the permanent fund restructuring. To do that, we need to have the ability to handle cash management in the Treasury side. And the CBR is going to be a critical component of that because we have the ability to borrow against the CBR during a fiscal year as long as we pay it back by the end of the year. So if we've got the flexibility within the CBR, we can structure it so that it becomes our cash management vehicle. We can make sure that we have liquidity when we need it, and by not have too much liquidity that we're actually not getting the investments that we need. And then as they realize gains on the permanent fund, they would transfer that to the Treasury, and the Treasury could then pay back the CBR. So we need to have that kind of flexibility within the CBR to be able to handle the cash management portion of the permanent fund restructuring. So it's going to be a critical tool in the process, but we want it set up in such a fashion that we can also squeeze up as great returns out of it as we possibly can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Hoffbeck, I like this provision. Would you agree it makes no sense if we don't come up with any sort of revenue plan, if all we're going to do is continue the same course of the past few years and just spend through the CBR, no matter whether we pass this or not, you're still going to have to invest it in short-term, low-interest instruments. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gary, if there's no permanent fund restructuring, we'll need it within 2 years, all of the money that's in here. And within a two-year window, you're going to keep it liquid and secure. There's no doubt. But when we start going 3, 4, and 5 years, as Representative Pruitt said, there is an opportunity to become a little less liquid, a little less secure, because markets typically have 1 or 2 years issues, not 5 year issues at a time. And so, yes, if there's no restructuring, it'll be gone in 2 years, and so we would keep it secure and liquid regardless.
Follow-up, Representative Guerra.
Thank you. So, and without any new revenue plan, if we just keep going the same course, when you say keep it liquid, that's something like 1-2% interest type instruments, not 8-9% returns?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, about 2%, yes.
Okay, thanks. Thank you, through the chair. I support this amendment, but we can only invest in long-term things, Commissioner Hoffbeck, if we find a way to raise revenue so that we don't have to deplete the constitutional budget reserve in the next 2 years. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gary, yes, I believe that's what I stated, that if it's only a two-year window, we will not be able to invest long-term with these funds.
Representative Newman and then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to get my thought into the last questioning here. Commissioner, does not the legislature have the ability to use the earnings reserve to fund government?
To the chair, Representative Newman, yes, it's money available for appropriation.
Mr. Chair, I believe we have $10.6 billion in the earnings reserve, or this earnings reserve.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I believe based on the current investment year-to-date, that's about correct.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I'm confused. If we're running $3 billion deficits, we have the ability to use the earnings reserve. There's 10.6 in there. There's at least 3 years' worth of reserves there. We just heard that we're going to run out of savings in 2 years. There's a CBR with another $4.6 billion in there. So the commissioner said that we're going to run out of reserves in 2 years. If we use the CBR and only the CBR, but we have the ability to use the earnings reserve too.
So, Chair, Representative, the CBR was the question, how long would the CBR last? So that's what I answered.
I'm trying to get that straight in my mind on the questions. But thank you for the leeway, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. I do have a couple other questions.
Sure. Follow-up, Representative, or new question, Representative Newman.
And I'm trying to figure out, Commissioner, has this changed the rules for the way the Department of Revenue can invest and manage the CBR?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, the implicit within the setting up of the CBR subaccount was that there would be a distinction between managing the two funds, that if it was in the main CBR fund, that was assumed to be needed to remain secure and liquid, because it was going to be used sometime within a five-year period. The sub-account was set up as a separate account within the CBR, where the assumption would be that would be invested more aggressively with a longer time horizon. And so I think as the law is currently structured, it's implied that if it's in the main account, that it would be invested in a more secure fashion. There's no structure within that says it absolutely has to be, but I think the intent of the law is that's what they wanted, how they wanted the CBR to be invested.
Follow-up?
I have a couple questions, if I may, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner, if you were going to take the money that's in the CBR and lock it into a subaccount for 5 or 6 years to be able to invest at a higher investment rate of return, which may be good, but wouldn't that take all that money off the table from use?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, we would not put it in the subaccount and have the longer time horizon if we thought that it was going to be needed within the 5 years. The idea by stripping out this 5 year requirement but maintaining the subaccount is we could look at a certain portion may be invested secure for 1 or 2 years, but when we get to 3 year, we can be a little bit more aggressive, and the 4 year a little bit more aggressive, and the 5 year we can have more of a progressive investment policy versus having this hard line at 5 years, which is pretty far out for keeping money liquid.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, again, how would we know if in 2 or 3 years oil crashed
price of oil went down in 6 months from $100 to $30. It caused the recession that we're in. It caused the problems that the state's in right now. We lost 80% of our revenue in 6 months. So if you were to put this into a sub-account and money in the CBR, which is Constitution's Budget Reserve, to use for funds when the state can't, when we don't have enough money coming in to support our budget, normally we've been going to the CBR to do that. But if that money's invested in another sub-account, you can't. I mean, how would you write a provision in there that you can pull that money back out? We don't know if you're going to need that money or not. I mean, the state's just proved that.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, the five-year provision isn't necessarily a five-year lockup of the funds, but it's a mindset on the amount of risk you're willing to take in investing the funds. You could put them in equities, which is a more risky investment and typically more likely to be in a longer-term portfolio, but it could be in an index fund that you cash in any time. So you'd still have access to the money, but you'd have it in a more risky portfolio that would have high and low swings within that period of time. So it's not that it's locked up or you can't get to it. It's just that you'd be taking more risk in the investment portfolio.
Mr. Chair? Representative Newman?
Would you have to pay penalties if you paid those off, if you took those off early?
Through the Chair, Representative Newman, not if it's in an index fund.
Another question?
Sure. Follow up?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm confused here, too, because I thought last year that we made it so that the CBR was to be managed by the Permanent Fund Dividend Corporation. Did that not pass?
Through the Chair, Representative Newman, that was in the Permanent Fund Protection Act bill last year.
Mr. Chair, I think maybe that's another option. I know when I talked to the Commissioner about this last year, he said, well, you know, they would like to try and invest it and make a higher rate of return. Normally, they've been running 2% or so in the CBR, where the ER, or the Permanent Fund Dividend Corp, tries to shoot for an 8%, making a little bit less than that. Last year made a lot less than that. There again, the ability to manage this, and maybe we should just allow the Permanent Fund Dividend Corporation, who's already got these sideboards, to manage the CBR fund, because they already have all the investment managers right there. I know that we continue to reduce the amount of money we have to run the Department of Revenue, and I've heard from the Commissioner on that, and he probably makes some good points because of the fiscal situation at the states, and that he'd love to have more personnel to be able to run this department. He's pretty short right now. And maybe if we could just use this to move it over and have the Permanent Fund Dividend Corporation, who we allowed to hire more investment managers recently, to be able to manage this. Just an option there. And I don't know if that's been discussed, and maybe that's what happens when you do an amendment in a bill. Thank you for now, Mr. Chair.
Through the chair, if I could respond to that. A couple of things. One of the reasons that we felt like it's better to leave the CBR within Treasury is simply that the Permanent Fund doesn't have the cash management structure. Right now, we manage $400 million worth of funds on a monthly basis, and it's set up so that funds mature and become available as needed, and that. Permanent Fund doesn't have that because they've had one draw a year and they just don't have that structure. So, and we would have to maintain that even if we move the CBR over to the Permanent Fund, because we still have all the other Treasury functions that we need to manage. So we'd actually be duplicating a process in the Permanent Fund that we have in Treasury already. Secondly, and this is to toot the horn of my staff a little bit, but in the last 34 years, Treasury has outperformed the Permanent Fund Corporation 22 years out of the 34. And so our staff is perfectly capable of managing the investments as well as the Permanent Fund when we have the same investment mandate. The issue with the CBR is it's got a different investment mandate, and I think when Director Rodell was here, she made that statement too, that if she had the same requirements for security and liquidity, she would have to invest it very similar to the way that Treasury has it invested as well. She could not put it in with all the other Permanent Fund investments and just hopefully have the money available when the time came. She would have to invest in a similar fashion. So I think the Treasury is every bit as capable of managing it and has the structure in place already. And we actually did do a study this summer and looking at where the CBR would best be fit. And the analysis came back that said you can put it in either place. It's about the same. So if it's going to be about the same, then let us do our job, which is cash management. Let them do their job.
Okay, just one follow-up on
Representative Newman.
Commissioner's comments, and just wanted to clarify, Commissioner. So, Randy, so then this does not change the investment sideboards that the Department of Revenue has and how they can invest in CVR?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, this would give me more flexibility so that I don't have that five-year hard line that that I have to keep it safe, secure, and liquid if I'm going to use it within 5 years. But I really do think that there's a kind of a two-year where it's prudent. The third year, you can be a little bit more aggressive. But when you start getting out 4 or 5 years, you can be substantially more aggressive. But under the five-year trigger that's in there, it essentially says lock it all up. So.
Mr. Chair, just something comes to mind, and I don't know if the Commissioner can respond to this, because I think it's probably a good amendment, and I'm trying to find problems with it. I mean, that's what we do, but it brings to mind last year some of the problems I believe that we had was state went out to sell some bonds, to look to see if they could sell some bonds, and it was information that I received. I believe that if they would have sold about $3.4 billion in bonds, that with the return on investment last year about -0.49% would have cost the state approximately $278 million if they would have sold those bonds this year. So right off the beginning, so when you start out in the negative on those, it's even harder to make that debt service, which is costing us now. So, Commissioner?
Through the chair, Representative, actually, at the point in time that we would have sold those bonds, which would have been last fall, the market was at essentially an all-time low, and we would have been able to put together a pension obligation bond sale, a multi-billion dollar sale that was probably the lowest pension obligation bond sale in history. We would have been all in the mid to 3.5 to 3.7% range on 20-year notes, all in. The returns since that point in time in the market have exceeded 14%. And so we would have sold them at the end of the downturn and invested them at the beginning of the upturn. And quite frankly, I think we missed an opportunity there. Now, markets go up and down, and a couple of years from now, and returns aren't so good, you might say, well, things don't look so rosy right now. But all we would have had to do is make somewhere around 3.6 or 3.7% on our return over 20 years to break even on those bonds. And if you can't make 3.6 or 3.7 return on your investment, you're probably in the wrong business. And so I think that was, to me, as close to a safe, large-scale investment that we possibly could have ever had. You can't control the returns side of it, but you can control your cost. And we had an opportunity at a very low cost of debt to have sold those bonds.
Yes, I'll let somebody else talk for a while.
Okay, next up we've got Representative Wilson and then Ortiz. And was there anybody else who wanted to jump into the queue here? Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems like we talk about a lot of things that don't necessarily have to do with the amendment, so I'm going to make sure I understand the amendment. So what this would do is allow revenue to make more money off of the money in the CBR. Is that correct?
So the chair, Representative Wilson. Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
And thank you for that clarification question. I really appreciate that. And so what's the potential downside? Is there more risk? Is that what we're saying?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, we would still have to follow the prudent investor rule. I mean, we would balance risk and reward like we would on any other investment. I think right now we are too safe by locking it up for 5 years. There's more potential than that.
Thank you.
Any further questions of the committee? Seeing none. Is the objection maintained, Representative Seaton?
I'll remove my objection.
Okay, the objection's been removed. Are there any further objections? Seeing none, amendment number 12 has been adopted. Moving on to amendment 13, Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move amendment number 13.
Any objections?
Object.
Object. We have an objection. Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is we're going to continue the discussion that we started the other day related to the draw limit.
I'm sorry, if we could just take a brief at ease here. We need to set up the laptop and the screens. And then we'll. Sorry about that. Thanks. At ease. Okay, if House Finance could come back to order, and we've got the laptops and screens all set up here. And Representative Pruitt, if you could reintroduce your or I think folks know that we're on record. Brief it is. Finance is back on record, and Representative Pruitt, if you could introduce the amendment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So we had a little bit of discussion on this the other day. This was the, well, I already moved it, and I believe it was already objected to.
We moved it.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a little bit of discussion the other day about the draw limit. The draw limit was a feature that was in SB 128 last year. And this is a mechanism that's in place that I believe, and I appreciate we've got the commissioner here as well as Brandon Brzezinski from Representative Thompson's office. I believe as we go through the discussion, but I will allow them to help understand this. You will find that this is a mechanism that ensures that the fund grows, as well as that the PFD potentially has the opportunity to grow as well. It's very, very difficult to look at this, what we have in front of us, and say, how is this going to work in the future? Of course, they've done some difficult modeling that can show some of that. But what this does is it ensures that at a certain point in time, there's a controlled amount of available in terms of the permanent fund available for us to spend. And it basically, as other revenues increase, as we would like to see them, it prevents the kind of that growth of government. So let me explain my concern, and why I like this. My concern is that the ease in which you can increase your spending as more revenue comes in, which I think we have a realistic understanding of that by looking at the last 10 years of state government. We had additional funds. We increased our spending as funds went in. And then when the crash came, we were scrambling to figure out what's going on. The goal with the draw limit is to temper that some. It doesn't completely stop that. If oil were to go back up to where it was there for a couple years, we'd still have additional available. But it controls some of that. The most important thing is that the less that you pull out of the permanent fund, the more that stays in the permanent fund to be able to grow, again, permanent fund dividends, but also the amount available to be spent in the future. And that, of course, is important. Let's say the oil continues to decline in terms of the throughput. That would be an important piece. What I'd like to do is I'd like to hand it over to the commissioner. I know the commissioner in the past has been very supportive. I believe he still is supportive of this, and allow him to explain a little bit more why he thinks this is a critical piece. I know he talked about it a little bit the other day, but why he feels it's just truly a critical piece of ensuring that some sort of a structured management of our PFD that this is a piece of it.
If I could have Ledge Finance and Alexi Painter come up to the table, it sounds like we have maybe some adjustments and some new modeling here, and I don't know if do you think it would be best if we started with what you have, Alexi, and then jump in? I don't know if there's an order that you want to do this.
Mr. Chair, actually, can I ask real quick?
Sure, Representative Pruitt.
Did everyone get a copy of this? Mm-hmm. Yep. That actually came from Department of Revenue. It was sourced from Department of Revenue, but Mr. Brzezinski might be able to speak to it. I know that he and I were having a conversation about it earlier. He may not be able to show all of these things in there, because I don't think Alexei has this modeling that the Department of Revenue has. But Mr. Brzezinski might be able to speak to it, or maybe Commissioner Hoffbeck.
Put yourself on the record.
For the record, Brandon Brzezinski, staff to Representative Thompson. So like Representative Pruitt said, that this information comes from the Department of Revenue. We just received it today, so it's relatively new. What I was able to do is just take out the parts in regards to the size of the permanent fund, the size of the PLMV, and the size of the permanent fund dividend. And what this chart will show is that, so the top row, well, first you have two columns without the draw limit and then with the draw limit. So the first row is showing like the median fund balance for both scenarios, which for FY18, well, that's $54 billion under revenues assumptions, and that does include the FY17 draw. So the second row down, you got the median 2041 or FY41 end of year fund balance. So you see you have the nominal amount on the left hand side. So for the case of the without the draw limit, it's $91 billion. That's the size of the fund. But that real value is $54 billion in today's dollars. So with the draw limit, though, you'll see that the nominal value is $109 billion and that the real value is $64 billion. So there's a $10 billion difference in real value by having the draw limit. Further, you go down to the POMV under HB 115. Without the draw limit, you'll have $2.8 billion for government. That is the two-thirds of the PLMV amount. It's $1.7 billion in real today. But with the draw limit, you'll have $3.3 billion or $1.9 billion real, so about $200 million more dollars for state spending. So then you go down to the dividend, because the assumption is like if you were to retain more money in your permanent fund, you will have it will earn more money and grow larger, right? So you see that in all here. So your dividend, since it's calculated off of one-third of the POMV, will also be bigger. So the FY21 median dividend per person, according to the Department of Revenue, without a draw limit, you're looking at about $1,077 real. But with a draw limit, you're looking at about $1,248 real, which I believe is consistent with an amendment that was added to this bill a couple days ago from Representative Guerra, to have $1,250 dividends for the next couple of years. So you will eventually hit that mark going forward according to the modeling.
We've got three questions here. Representative Kawasaki, then Guerra, then Newman.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just a plain question. Just on the, so you're talking about in year 2041? Is that why it was modeled? It was modeled out to 2041?
Yeah. Hmm.
Commissioner Hoffbeck?
Through the Chair, Representative Kawasaki. For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner Reverend. Yes, we ran our model for 24 years.
That seems a little arbitrary. I'm not sure why it was done for 24 years. And I guess what I'd like to see maybe is something that's a little bit more near term. 2041's, I think I'll still be around, but it seems like a long time. And I'd rather see something a little bit closer to. Thanks.
Okay, next up we have Representative Guerra, and then Newman, and then Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, obviously the more money that you can put in the permanent fund, the bigger the permanent fund will grow and the more money can be spun out of the permanent fund. And by 2041, there's about a $500 million difference. But to do that, you have to flatline your budget between like $75 a barrel and $105 a barrel, at least in FY18 numbers. So I don't really know how to compare this, like what we can get in 2041 by flatlining revenue. No.
Through the Chair, Representative Garrett, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. If the question is what the impact of the flatlining is, That essentially is what you're seeing in the difference in the balances that been going, having that fixed draw for a period of time is what creates the additional revenues in the permanent fund. So without the draw limit, what you would have is the left hand column. And with the right, the draw limit gives you that additional benefit.
Through the chair.
Representative Kerr.
Yeah, my problem is, and obviously nobody can put every single circumstance on a chart, that would be silly, but for the next 10 years, let's say the next 10-year horizon, you do want to make sure you have funds available for schools, for what Representative Thompson always reminds us is the roughly $1 billion of deferred maintenance over at the university, the deferred maintenance across the state, road construction. And so one of the main issues is if oil prices hit the $75, $80 a barrel mark, the question is, are we able to have the funds available to do energy projects in rural Alaska, fund schools the way we want to fund them? And this chart doesn't answer any of this. This just says that in 2041, there will be more money in the permanent fund. So I guess I don't know really what to do with this sheet of paper.
Through the chair, Representative Garrett. Well, with more money in the fund means more money for government, which means more money for schools. And, you know, if you wanted, it provides sustainability, it grows the fund, it grows how much you have every year going forward if you keep the money in the fund, you know, as a result of compound interest and earnings.
Through the chair.
Representative Garrett.
It's only more funds available for schools if you look at the combined revenue for the state, the combined earnings reserve and oil revenue. And this version assumes an income tax. Your other version with the longer deficit assumes no income tax. But I don't think you have more money available for schools under this in total revenue, just that portion of revenue that comes from the earnings reserve, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner Revenue. Yes, that's correct. I mean, this was never intended to be the entire plan. And so the idea is some of the other revenue sources that you would have would be also available for funding those additional services. So this just kind of determines how the permanent fund portion will be used. And really it was developed because of the fear of hyperinflating spending in high oil price years, where you just take oil prices that were more than sufficient to fund government services and add another $2 billion on top of it. And if you take this piece out, essentially you need to ratchet down your draw in all years, which means you actually have less money available currently for funding services.
Representative Guerra.
Yeah. Through the chair, Alexi, is this the model that, there's a debate in this building right now whether there should be no revenue plan, a permanent fund only revenue plan, oil taxes, income taxes? What's the version that shows for those people who say there should be a permanent fund only plan? Is that this one, or is this with an income tax?
For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. Representative Garrett, through the chair, this is showing House Bill 115 as it is currently drafted with an income tax. We can show it without the income tax portion if you want to see that. The other thing is that we added was in response to your question from 2 days ago, we can actually show the impact from FY18 through 26 in each year. So it may help answer some of the questions about what the impact would be going forward in years with lower production perhaps and higher budget numbers. You'd like to see that. So without the income tax, without the draw limit, the budget wouldn't be balanced until roughly $85 a barrel oil. And with the draw limit in FY18, that wouldn't happen until $105 a barrel oil. Going forward in future years, without the income tax, again, under House Bill 115, without the income tax, that's a similar situation. So I'm just going through the years. There's a persistent deficit. However, with the income tax, you can see that roughly the line matches each time. And so the assumption here is the OMB budget, which gives budget growth after a few years, and House Bill 115 is currently drafted. So with that, the budget line approximately meets the flat spot on the expenditure limit in the following years. So even though production is declining, so at the same price you're getting less revenue, your POMV is larger because that's growing at roughly the rate of inflation. So those two counteract each other somewhat.
So one last question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Garrett.
Yeah. So there could be a million questions, I know, on these charts. The one I really had was it seemed like this draw limit kicked in somewhere around $80 a barrel, which, according to the revenue forecast, was somewhere around 2024. And then I asked you, and I think you've done it, well, what is production forecasted to be in 2024? So I guess under the Senate's preference, which is just a permanent fund plan in 2024, what would this look like, and how long would the deficit last?
Representative Guerra, I will switch to the Senate plan, if you wouldn't mind, just because this is showing House Bill 115, which has a higher amount to...
Let me ask you to stick with HB 115 if only the permanent fund part passed.
Okay.
And then you can do all the other ones.
So this is showing House Bill 115 without the income tax in FY24. Could show Senate Bill 26.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, next up we've got Representative Newman, then Ortiz, and then Seaton. Representative Newman.
This is getting more interesting all the time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brzezinski, I'm just on this chart, the blue chart. Did I hear you say that with the draw limit, there would be an additional $200 million for state spending in 24 years?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, according to the modeling, with the draw limit in place, you will have more money from the POMV for government spending, and then more money from dividends as well. So yes, because according to the model, more money, more of the permanent fund earnings will be retained in the permanent fund because of oil revenues hitting the $1.2 billion trigger. So you leave those permanent fund earnings in the permanent fund to earn more interest to grow, and that will grow the fund. So yes, it will grow the fund. If you look at the chart, you'll see the difference in the balances with the draw limit, without a draw limit, in the sense that your POMV is based on an average, like a five-year leg average of your overall size of your permanent fund. You know, if you have a bigger fund, you have a bigger average, and you do your 5% POMV, you'll have a bigger draw. So yes.
Another question, Chair.
Okay, go ahead, Representative Newman.
I'm trying to figure out a little bit more on this. So the limit threshold will be set at $1.2 billion. That's the amount of money that the state could take out of the CBR. What's the draw limit on?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner Reva. The $1.2 billion is the oil and gas tax revenues that once you hit $1.2 billion, for every additional dollar oil and gas tax and royalty, you reduce the dividend draw or the permanent fund draw by $1 per. So once you hit $1.2 billion in oil and gas tax royalties and taxes and royalties, you start reducing your draw on the permanent fund dollar for dollar. So the permanent fund will continue to grow, and it'll grow over time. And so, and that does that. There's no, the permanent fund can grow as large as you want. It doesn't trigger the draw limit. Only the oil and gas tax and royalties triggers the draw limit.
I just reading some notes here, Mr. Chair, if I may. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It says the POMV would be reduced by $1 for every dollar of oil production tax not to exceed. So when we're saying the POMV, is the percent of market value, is that the permanent fund dividend paid, the check that the people are going to get? I just want to make sure we're
so clear. Representative, the PRMV is the total draw for government services and the check. As the when you hit the draw limit, it reduces the government services piece, but the dividend check does not go down. It's always calculated based on the maximum draw.
So if there's a cap for every dollar on that, is there a mechanism here that would put additional money back in for permanent fund dividend checks?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, as the fund value grows, the 5.25 or 5% draw grows, and so the dividend would grow would grow as well. So the more money that's in the fund, the larger their dividend is going to be.
So I'm going to go back to your charts that you got here, and I see the bottom line is still deficit. So even at 24 years out, with an income tax and using a permanent fund dividend fund government, we're still running over a $1 billion deficit.
Alexi Peter, for the record, Representative Newman through the chair, that was showing without the income tax. With the income tax, the deficits would disappear at around $75 barrel oil.
That was a yes.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, the previous version, this is without the income tax. There would be persistent deficits with the income tax. The deficits would not be there at the higher prices.
Thank you, Mr. I'll come back.
Representative Ortiz? Yes.
Couple of questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I understand the term real dollars, it takes into account the impact of inflation, but is there an assumed inflation rate throughout 2041, or does that not matter necessarily what the actual inflation rate is?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the inflation rate is assumed to be 2.25%.
All the way out to 2041?
Correct.
And is it, can I follow up?
Representative Ortiz,
I'm old enough, you're old enough to remember where inflation used to be significantly higher. If it does turn to be significantly higher, does that impact this particular model in any way?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, it's going to impact it in a lot of different ways. And higher inflation, higher interest rates would also typically mean higher investment returns as well. So it would help.
It would balance out.
It would tend to balance out. But
yeah,
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you. And I understand how the no income tax option extends the deficit. That makes sense to me. What's the opportunity cost of that extended deficit? In other words, everybody likes the idea of no taxes, but what's the opportunity cost of that extended deficit? In other words, does it assume that we'll have the revenue from some source to make up for that deficit, or will our other savings accounts go away quicker? How does that work?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the assumption is that you would spend your other savings down first, and then you would start going into the permanent fund earnings. That's where it becomes puts the greatest stress on the model, is the unplanned draws against the earnings reserve is the greatest threat to jeopardizing the stability of the plan. But this doesn't distinguish the solution. It says you can do it with a lower budget, you can do it with more revenues, but you do have to deal with that fiscal gap some way. This model just doesn't tell you what your solution is. So,
Representative Ortiz.
One last question. Okay, so it assumes that there's no income tax or that there's no other added revenue, but the reality is of an extended deficit is we're going to need other added revenue. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the assumption is that you need revenues or a smaller budget, one or the other. The permanent fund itself is not sufficient to solve the entire issue.
Thank you.
So I guess I was next on the list. So, Alexi, can you make some changes here. Would you go to, can you do a 50 cents on the dollar reduction? So in this case, we haven't changed, we've gained revenue out past a $90 barrel of oil at a more rapid rate than on the left hand, on the right hand side, but we're still, if we have the revenue reduction in there, we're still running a deficit to a higher point. What about changing that to 1.5 billion?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Wilson.
Could you tell us exactly the things that you're changing? Are they where they are in the amendment, just so I can understand? Like, I don't know whether you're trying to amend the amendment with the changes that you're putting up there. I'm kind of lost.
Sure. We could look at changing the dollar for dollar to either 80 cents or 50 cents. If you want to look at that in the exact.
I don't see it in the amendment.
So, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I can kind of explain. So, for instance, over there, the $1.5 million, that if you look at the amendment under number two, so C2, the sum of 1200, so that would be effectively changing the $1.2 billion that's there to $1.5 billion. Does that make sense?
That's in line 19.
That would, yes, that would be in line 19. Gotcha. The other side, the dollar for dollar, in this case, it would be 50 cents for every dollar. That is, I'm trying to, where it's actually, it's under number 10, or line 10. So the remainder, well, 9 and 10, the remainder of the amount calculated will be available distribution under B of this section shall be reduced by the difference between the amount calculated in one of this subsection and the amount under two of this subsection. So what it's doing is it's...
I have no idea what he's doing.
Hold on. I'm going to clarify that. It takes basically, it doesn't say, they can't put in here dollar for dollar. They have to take the amount that's calculated in, under another subsection, which is actually in the bill, and a separate subsection, and it says whatever the difference is, it will be reduced once it hits it. It's the legalese way of saying dollar for dollar, or in this particular case, changing it to say 50 cents for every dollar. So the bulk of C there is the legalese way of saying what we're trying to say very simply with the dollar for dollar conversation.
Does that help? Chairman, that helps. I didn't even know if we were on the amendment the way you were changing things up there. So it helps a lot. Thank you.
So I guess what I'm hoping we can do is, as we look at this structure, figure out where we are, and remembering this isn't the time series is the toggle. And would you toggle through that so that we can see what it looks like over time?
And this, Mr. Chair?
So, Representative Newman.
I see that going over time, but I've been interested in UGF budget, and I see the UGF budget going up very small. Is that inflation running at 2.5%? So if you were to run the UGF budget, it increases in that at 2.5%, that line. Does that change the calculations?
For the record, Alexei Painter, Legislative Finance. Representative Newman, through the chair, the budget assumption for the operating budget is the for the agency operations is essentially flat for the next 2 years and then increasing with inflation. Some of the statewide items, such as debt service, actually are not quite increasing with inflation, so that we expect to decline because of the pause in the school debt reimbursement. And then the state assistance retirement would increase. So some of these sort of offset that the entire budget we wouldn't assume quite grows with inflation in our default budget assumption, but it does increase somewhere close to the inflation rate.
Representative Seaton, and then we have in the line Gren and Guerra.
Yeah, and so it's kind of hard to see which toggles are doing what. Could you take that to $2 billion so that we can see what happens there?
$1.5 billion.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to figure out. So then we're looking at the before the revenue limit kicks in, the going up from 1.2 to 1.5 to $2 billion extends out to a higher price before that starts, and the dollar per dollar or so it looks like there's not a lot of, oh, okay, there is. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's looking like if we were at $1.5 billion instead of 1.2, we would start turning down at about $95 a barrel, and then the one and a, would you go back to the 50 cents? Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like that that would give us some some greater security there for getting budgets that aren't going to be in deficit and making up capital projects and all at that turnout. Mr. Hoffbach, is there any reason why that 50 cents per dollar and $1.5 billion being the key point would not would be unadvisable within the model as you see it?
To the Chair, Representative Seaton, we'd have to model it. The chances are that it would require a lower base draw in order not to increase the failure rate of the depleting the earnings reserve over time. So we'd have to remodel it to just see.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Seaton.
And can we ask you to do that? Because it seems like the what's happening in the model that we're seeing here from Ledge Finance is it gives us a little more security in other ways of going forward, but not keeping ourselves into deficit spending over a longer period of time so that we can actually recover and do some of what Representative Thompson is talking about on deferred maintenance and all once we start getting higher oil prices. So if we could request you to do that, I'd appreciate it.
So, Chair, just to clarify, 50 cents and 15 and $1.5 billion, that's the model you want to run.
That would be great, and I don't know how difficult it is. If it's not too difficult, maybe it's 75 cents as well.
We could run a couple. We'll try and put together a matrix on it.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that if it's okay, I just wanted to inject there because I think one of the things that I didn't highlight earlier that I think is important to recognize is and Commissioner Hoffbeck just highlighted it. It's the models also indicate, and we've seen this in other things, the potential for failure, the potential for us to erode away the permanent fund. And one of the things that I think that they had modeled, and of course they've modeled several different things. They've modeled a full fiscal plan, which includes the cuts and some of those other things. They've modeled yours, Mr. Chair, with the permanent fund and income tax only, and not including the cuts and the other pieces to it. And what happens is you see different levels based on a cap or having the limit or not having the limit of the potential for failure to take place. And probably the greatest, if we were to do the if full fiscal plan as deemed, which would include cuts and we filled the full gap of our of the deficit. What's interesting is in 2041, the likelihood of failing, the likelihood of not hitting that is only 1.43. Without the draw limit, it's 8.64. Huge difference there. And I think that's one of the things that I think when he comes back with the models, I'd ask everyone to consider and to look at is we can drive the permanent fund to do what we want it to do. What we have to we can do a lot of things. The question is what is our emphasis going to be? If we want to protect the permanent fund, we have to consider the possibility that it could that we could the earnings reserve itself could go to nothing, and that we could the failure of the earnings reserve is a possibility. But that we have to consider that in the whole in the overarching discussion. And so I'm interested in what we'd see from this. But as we drive more money to pay for government, I'd be interested in how that failure rate substantially changes. And so I would ask when they come back to consider that failure rate, because we don't want to find in 2041, and I know that's a long ways off, but that's not a long ways off, that's 24 years. We don't want to have that possibility of not having an earnings reserve at that point in time as well. So I just wanted to throw that out there that I think it was kind of – he highlighted it but just real briefly, but I wanted to make sure everyone caught on how important that particular piece is going to be.
So in the queue we've got – okay, Commissioner Hoffbeck, and then after Commissioner Hoffbeck we've got a queue here. Representative Grimm will be after, and then Guerra, and then Newman. Commissioner Hoffbeck.
Through the chair, the two other things that we need to consider is also that if the draw limit is set at a higher threshold and the dollar for dollar is reduced to something less than dollar for dollar, it also impacts four times draw because you won't build reserves as quickly, which means it impacts the inflation proofing of the fund. And in addition, it also creates more volatility, which that was one of the primary reasons that this was put in here was to take volatility out of the funding sources for government expenditure. So those components need to be considered as well. But we'll bring them all back.
Okay, thank you. Next up, we've got Representative Grimm, and then Guerra, and then Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah, I just wanted to confirm that compared to the original amendment, this sort of setup is would be if someone had a question who was trying to, like Representative Guerra, who maybe wanted to build a capital budget or something, this would be the setup you would go after. Is that correct? More for government.
Through the chair, Representative Grimm. If you take the draw limit out, you will have spikes in certain years that you could harvest for a capital project program. The concern is that there's also an opportunity to grow programs when you have revenues that spike for short periods of time, and that becomes a real problem because then as revenues begin to drop, you don't have a sustainable funding source for those programs. So it does open an opportunity for capital programs, but it also does open an opportunity for some decisions that may not be as healthy.
And quick follow-up, and thank you for that. I meant reducing it from a dollar to dollar and $1.2 billion, reducing it 50 cents and then increasing it. That would increase the amount for back to government services.
Through the chair, Representative Grimm, that's correct. It would grow the amount available at higher oil prices. That would be available for government service because you would not turn down the permanent fund draw as much.
Mr. Brzezinski.
Through the chair, also I wanted to add, Representative Grimm, like if you raise the threshold and lower the 50 cents on the dollar, like going forward, you will likely result in the real value of your permanent fund will be less than what's on this dollar for dollar at $1.2 billion. So, you know, and also take in mind, like, HB 115 has reduced the royalty contributions to the permanent fund, and it's gotten rid of the statutory inflation proofing. It's relying on that four times rule. So, if, you know, without that four times rule triggering, you know, you're drawing more from the fund with a 50 cents on a with a higher threshold, so you're spending more from your earnings reserve, less likelihood to trigger that four times rule, and less likelihood to inflation proof the permanent fund. You have your quarter percent PMV draw as well, but it's not, you know, $120 million is, you know, it helps. It does help. So, you know, any if you raise that threshold and lower that the offset, it's you're going to result have a smaller permanent fund, which will result in a smaller PMV and a smaller PFD. So. So, and yeah.
I like the amendment. I'm just trying to get my mind moving up and down what it's doing.
Okay, next up we have Representative Guerra and then Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it's like the language keeps changing. So when Commissioner Rodell was here and when Legislative Finance presented just on the permanent fund part, the four times waterfall worked, the 5.25% PMV, which then goes down to 5%, worked without what I view as the you're not allowed to use your oil revenue limit is the way I see it. But to me, this all seems academic if until we resolve with the Senate whether there's going to be any additional revenue beyond just permanent fund revenue. So if you would go back to the Senate's preference, please, just let's say it's their preference of a permanent fund only plan.
Mr. Chairman, that's not the amendment, and I'm getting, for me, it's confusing going back and forth from a bill that's not before us.
Chair,
to this one, because can I finish?
Yeah.
So
well, you're interrupting.
Representative Wilson.
Well, the reason is because if we're talking about this bill only, an amendment to this bill, if another bill comes over, this may or may not be part of it because maybe it doesn't work in the same fashion. So, I mean, to compare what would happen in another bill that's not before us, I don't know whether the Representative Thompson would even offer this amendment in a different bill. So I think it's more important to understand how it works in this particular one.
And just a quick at ease. Okay, House Finance is back on order. We'll go ahead and allow, a little bit of digression here just to make sure, I guess, we're seeing this from all different aspects, and so I'll go ahead and allow it. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I need to understand is, I mean, we have to just recognize that as of today, there's a difference in opinion in the legislature. And if we end up with... what some in the building want, which is only a permanent fund only plan, I just need to know if we put the draw limit in this bill, and that's all we get, what the impact is going to be. And it's so if you could show me sort of permanent fund only plan, which I guess is this chart, is that correct?
Representative Garrett, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance. This is House Bill 115 without the income tax.
Okay, and then could you show me, we get to the point on this thing where we're at about $85 a barrel, that's where things kick in, but we don't get to $85 a barrel, let's say, till about 2024. So could you show me 2024's projected numbers? Thank you. Through the chair, it seems that we're in deficit mode until $95 a barrel under this version with the payout limit. Is that correct?
Representative Guerra, that's correct.
And then were the folks who say permanent fund only plan to prevail, would we even have enough money in the CBR to make that last till 2024?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, this, I will show you the main model output for House Bill 115 without the income tax. The CBR would last through FY26 in that situation.
I see. Thank you, through the chair. Through the chair, I'll just make my comment. Until this issue is resolved, I can't see, you know, I could see maybe a 25-cent or 50-cent per dollar cap being considered or discussed after we see where we get with all of the members in this legislature. But until then, it's just it's not a provision I want to consider because I think it just sort of keeps us in austerity until we know what our revenue looks like.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Next up, we have Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm not asking the right questions, I'm still trying to get caught up here. Been a few months. So I'm looking at this and then stay right where we're at. So it's 50 cents on a per dollar. So I'm looking at the revenue payout limit and I'm looking at the blue line of volatile cash. First off, what is volatile cash? It's just cash?
Representative Newman, through the chair, the revenue that's under the limit is only the production tax and unrestricted general fund royalties. It does not include other revenue sources such as corporate income taxes and property taxes.
Okay. So I'm looking at this, and without the limit, there's more revenue at $100. You don't get, I mean, there's just more revenue above a $4.2 billion. I guess we're up to more than that now. We're up to 24. That's why we're near 24. But if we were in year 18, it's still the same thing, to where fiscal year 18, where there's more revenue without the pay limit. Is that more revenue for the state? I mean, overall revenue?
Representative Newman, through the chair, the POMV payout would be reduced under the revenue limit at those high prices, so there'd be more revenue without it. That money instead would stay in the earnings reserve.
Mr. Brzezinski?
Through the chair, Brandon Brzezinski, staff to Rep. Thompson. Aside from price as well, Representative Newman, production will also offset or trigger the draw limit as well, so more, because royalties are a portion of what calculates the $1.2 billion threshold, so it's not solely based on price, as we're seeing in these charts here.
I'm just looking
at these charts. You'll notice it's dollars, correct? It's the price, but in the event, like, which we know there are significant fines that are being talked about in the news, that if we got more production in the pipeline, that would also adjust.
I get it.
Right. Okay.
I know, okay. If we got more oil in the pipeline, we have more revenue.
Yeah.
I get that.
Right. Well,
and if the price is higher, it goes up too.
Well, I was just clarifying, it's not solely based on price.
Okay. A couple questions, Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
So then I'm looking, without the limit, there's more revenue. And if there's more oil in the pipeline and more funding, there's more revenue too. And then I'm looking at the green POMV payout with the limit. And the POMV payout is the payout of the permanent fund. That's the permanent fund payout, right? So with the limit, and I extended out 24 years, it goes to nothing. What am I missing here? Am I backwards in that thinking, or what?
Alexi,
this is showing a single year, just FY18, so that you would, as prices are higher in that year, there would be less, a smaller POMV draw, in this case 50 cents on the dollar. So for every dollar more of volatile revenue you received, you'd reduce your POMV draw by 50 cents. That's not to say that in the future your POMV draw would be lower, but just in that year you would essentially substitute one type of revenue for another.
That last sentence again. Your voice tends to fall off when you're done talking, so I didn't hear that last.
Representative Newman, through the chair, as the way with the dollar for dollar replacement, if your oil revenue increases by $1 above $1.2 billion, the POMV would be reduced by a dollar. So while you would get more revenue because prices went up, you would receive the same amount overall because it would substitute that oil revenue for POMV.
And the dividend check would continue to increase at a greater rate?
Representative Newman, through the chair, in that 1 year, it would have no impact on the dividend check. However, because it would leave more money in the fund in future years when that year is incorporated in the average, it would be a higher dividend check.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further questions of the committee? Seeing no questions, I think we have some more modeling that's been asked for. So we will hold off on Amendment 13 and hold off on HB 115. Is there anything else I'm forgetting before we close it out? Seeing nothing, our next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for Monday, March 27th at 1:30 p.m. At this meeting, we'll have an introduction of HB 111, Oil and Gas Tax, Production Tax, and we'll also revisit this HB 115. With that, we are adjourned. The time now is 4:42 p.m. Thank you.